address at the United States Military Academy sesquicentennial at West Point, 20 May 1952.
Ladies and gentlemen, President of the United States. Secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and distinguished guests. I want to make a statement, just two short statements, before I start my regular talk. I had a luncheon at noon with 9 Missouri cadets, and I want to say to them, and I'm saying it very publicly, that I haven't had a more pleasant luncheon in many a day. I appreciated it very much. I have another statement to make. You know, the President has several positions in which he works. He's President of the United States, he's President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, he's the social head of the state, and head of the state, and he's the head of his party, an armed party, and I'm going to work in two of those capacities right this minute, as President of the United States and with a Constitution. The President has power to pardon anybody for anything but impeachment. Of course, he couldn't pardon himself. So, exercising my authority as President of the United States under the Constitution, I direct the Commandant of West Point to relieve all the special punishment that's going on the post today. Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, I direct General Irvin to carry out that order. Now, you know, I'm in a sort of a position that Senator Barkley found himself in one time. And I want this to be distinctly understood that I am joyed immensely. The two speeches that were made before me, they were wonderful. I hope I can make half the contribution that either one of those wonderful men made. But Senator Barkley was the last on the program, and Senator Barkley likes to speak. And he took his watch out and put it on there. Stand, and he spoke for a minute, and he picked it up and put it to his ear and shook it. Some old gentleman out in the audience says, "Senator, if it stops, there's a calendar behind you." Well, you're not going to need a calendar because this is not that long, and I hope it won't be as boring. be as boresome as you may anticipate it will be. It is a real pleasure for me to be here today and to join, and for me to be here today and to join in celebrating the establishment of, the United States Military Academy at West Point, 150 years ago. This academy was started during Thomas United States. United States at that time was relatively small and weak, and surrounded by dangers. We just fought a limited and unmatched to protect the freedom of our commerce and shipping. We were engaged in fighting another limited and undeclared war with the Barbary pirates for the same purpose. Jefferson, like Washington and Hamilton, and other leaders of our young republic knew very well that a strong was racing, and these patriot leaders knew also that you cannot have effective military forces unless you have well-trained, well-prepared officers. They all knew how Washington had to struggle and experiment all through the revolution. To find officers who could take troops into battle and lead them to victory. That was why they wanted a great deal of opposition. To starting a military academy in this country. It took 20 years of argument and persuasion after the revolution was over before the academy could be started. Now listen to this, and it was finally started. Largely because Jefferson took the position that if the Congress didn't authorize a military academy, he'd start one himself. The argument over establishing a military academy. Was part and parcel of the argument over whether the United States should have strong national defenses. That argument has continued to the present day, and much of the debate after the revolution is very, very modern. They are making those same old arguments today, just as they made about the military academy when Jefferson was founded. There were a lot of people in this country in 1800
who were afraid
Academy
would make us belligerent and warlike. You can hear echoes of that point of view today in the debate over universal military training. There were a lot of other people in 1800 who said that a strong national defense would cost too much, that it would cost too much, that we couldn't afford it too much, that we couldn't afford it, that we couldn't afford it, that we ought to find some magic formula, for achieving security without having to pay for it. That point of view is not only echoed today. It's loudly shouted in the newspapers in the hall of Congress. These arguments did not prevail against the hard-headed common sense of men like Jefferson. The military academy was set up. And this country has had occasion to be thankful many times since then that our early so much foresight. The military academy has repaid this country many it has cost. We have learned from experience that while it may be expensive to maintain a strong national defense, it is much more expensive not to have one. Time and again, we have allowed our armed forces to dwindle to a fraction of what they should have been, because of our lack of preparedness. There are people right now who want us to relax and cut down on our defense program. They are just as wrong as they can be. We must pay the cost of preventing a world war, or we will surely have to pay the immensely greater cost of fighting one. The other fear of the early opponents of the military academy has also proved groundless. Our country's never become warlike or aggressive. That's partly because our Constitution nailed down so firmly the principle of civilian control over the military. The most important means by which this was done was by providing in the Constitution that the President, who is the civilian head of the government elected by the people, shall be Commander-in-Chief of all the military forces. Many presidents, including the present one, have demonstrated that those words in the Constitution mean just what they say. But in addition to this, The spirit of our people has never been warlike. Our people came to this country to find peace and freedom. That's what we've always wanted. That's what we want now. And that is what our national policy is designed to preserve. But there's a vast difference between being peaceful and being passive. Being peaceful and being passive. We want to be peaceful and being passive. Being peaceful and being passive. We want to achieve peace, but we know peace. But we know we can't. But we know we can't. But we know we can't have it unless we can't have it unless we are willing to stand up for our rights. We know we can stand up for our rights. We know we can't have lasting peace unless we work actively and vigorously to bring up about conditions of freedom and justice in the world. That is what we are trying to do. We are having to do it in the face of a concerted campaign of threats and sabotage and outright aggression directed by the Soviet Union. The policies of the Soviet Union are exactly the opposite of our own. We want to establish equality and justice in the rule of quality and justice in the rule of law among all nations. They want to establish domination of justice and the rule of law among all nations. They want to establish domination and dictatorship and the rule of force over all countries. The bubble of the individual. And they also control countries. The Bolsheviks want physical control of the individual. And they also want to control his thoughts and his soul. This makes our situation, the situation of all free nations, difficult and dangerous in the extreme. But I am firmly convinced that it does not necessarily mean a third world war. The free countries can, by proper and adequate defense measures, make clear to the Kremlin that aggression would be doomed to failure. And the free nations can by economic and political means, so as to escape from communist infiltration and subversion. But strong and active as we may be, we cannot avoid the risks and sacrifices. They are inherent in the situation, and we cannot wish them out of existence. The course of events is not come. In Korea, we have no choice but to meet armed aggression with military force. If we had not met a United Nations Charter would have been reduced to a scrap of. This aggression had been allowed, the communist conquest of all Asia would have been simply a matter of time. If the United Nations had failed and Asia had fallen, we would have been well on the way to a disintegration of freedom in the whole world. The valor and sacrifices of United States fighting men, together with the forces of the Republic of Korea and the contingents from 15 other countries has beaten the aggressors back within their own territory. Our army, led in large part by men trained here at West Point, has done a superb job. From the time our men were first sent into action, in the gallant rear guard defense, and the gallant rear guard defense down to Pusan perimeter. From then right on up to the present, the United States Army and the men who have fought with them in the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps, and from the armed forces of other free countries, have been just as brave and just as effective. Last June, 11 months ago, the badly battered communists offered to confer about a military armistice in Korea. We were willing to conclude such an armistice, and we still are. We don't want any more fighting than is necessary. But we were not interested, and we are not interested, and we are not interested now. We are fighting. Patiently and skillfully, General Ridgway and his negotiating team, headed by Admiral Joy, have worked to bring about an effective armistice. They have done a masterful job in the face of great provocation. They have met threats and abuse and outright lies. With great self-control and an unyielding insistence, just an honorable armistice. Gradually, the communists have come to realize that we will not sacrifice our principles to obtain an armistice. We do not know whether they will finally agree. On an honest and workable armistice. So far, they have agreed to some of the points that must be covered. They have agreed that the armistice line across Korea should be a defensible military line determined by the location of the opposing forces. They have agreed that no reinforcements shall be brought into Korea by either side during the armistice. They have agreed that an inspection commission shall observe the carrying out of the armistice terms, and are apparently willing to withdraw the request that the Soviet Union should be one of the neutral inspecting nations. Up to now, however, the communists have not agreed upon a fair and proper exchange of prisoners of war. The communists have continued to insist that all the prisoners we have taken must be handed over to them, regardless of whether or not they are willing to be sent back behind the Iron Curtain, and regardless of what their fate would be if they were sent back. It is perfectly clear that thousands and thousands of prisoners we hold would violently resist being returned to the communists because they fear the slavery or death which would await them. It would be freedom and justice for which we are fighting if we force these men at bayonet point to return to their ex-masters. We won't do it. We won't buy an armistice by trafficking in human slavery. We do not know whether the communists will accept that position. We may not know for some time yet, continuing under General Clark's direction. We shall remain ready to reach honorable settlement by peaceful means. But we must also be alert and ready to meet treachery. Or a renewal of aggression if that should come. During these months of armistice negotiations in Korea, the communists have increased their military strength. They have more men there than they had a year ago, and many more tanks and planes. But we have consolidated and increased our strength in Korea also. The morale of our men is high, and our unit high, and our units are well trained, well equipped, and at a peak of combat efficiency.